Go ahead, lounge around in bed with a good magazine. We'll even read it to you. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Live. On Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Even you, Calgary. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live. Ben Ennis alongside John Greig, Jeff Simmons on the Sportsnet Radio Network. And we welcome Calgary for the first time ever to this fine radio program. Lots to get to. Stanley Cup playoffs. Blue Jays stink, although they're pitching a little bit better. We will also get to the MasterCard Memorial Cup, which opened up yesterday. But I know we have Calgary on for the first time. I mean, we're not usually totally Toronto-centric, but my goodness. I mean, how do we not start with what went on with the Toronto Maple Leafs and the hiring of a new coach in Mike Babcock and all the drama that's led up to it and actually went into the signing and the drama that surrounded the Buffalo Sabres and then the return to Detroit the other day and the tears and all of it. Oh, it's just, I'm emotionally drained, John.
It's awesome. It's like high school.
It
right?
is.
It's a lot, like, you know, you're dumping your girlfriend. You're kind of playing the field a little bit, but then you got to go talk to her parents after, you know, right after you come and talk to the new parents. It's awesome. I love that kind of stuff. Intrigue during the off season.
And you just don't want to get pregnant. Actually, I don't know how that applies here, but so Mike Babcock is the new head coach. It was speculated for months and months and months. And I don't know, me personally, it really seemed like the winds were blowing towards him returning to Detroit. Doesn't end up going down that way. It looked like, and then, you know, recently as just a couple of days ago, I think 95% of people thought he was going to the Buffalo Sabres. They were in negotiations. How that fell apart depends on who you believe, but the Sabres believed they had a deal in place for him. Didn't happen. He's with the Toronto Maple Leafs. And for the cool sum of over $6 million per, over 8 years, $50 million term. And I guess, Jeff, when you look at this overall, this team is trying to sell you hope. You know you're going to be a basement dweller, you imagine. I mean, anything can happen in sports for the next few years. But is it all good, or at least more all good now, that you have a head coach and a Mike Babcock?
Oh, absolutely. They didn't get Connor McDavid. That was the one other thing that could have given this franchise hope. They didn't get him. They had such a disastrous season. And when you hear who the alternative was, the reports came out that would have been Guy Boucher as the likely head coach. That is the complete opposite of hope. If you can get a guy, like, how do you sell that?
I don't know. I mean,
Guy Boucher is like guy. 2 years ago, though. Guy Boucher was the, like, the bright light, the young mind, the guy everybody wanted.
Yeah,
right?
So was Dallas Eakins, though. What happened to that?
Right.
So in terms of hope, this is the big fish. And it just seemed like such a pipe dream. Throughout the year, the Leafs were hoping for McDavid. They were hoping for Babcock. And it seemed like he was going to Buffalo, like you just said. They had the fancy new owner, and they have all the money and the relationship with the GM. And out of nowhere, Toronto just comes up. And that has to be stunning for their fans and for the people in the city. And
sure.
No one could have saw this coming. The Leafs just seemed like they were being used for the negotiations to build up the salary.
Yeah.
Out of the blue, 8 years, $50 million. All of a sudden, they got the best coach in the game.
I love the acrimony from the Buffalo media. Like, they're just so pissed off that this happened. And it's like, dude's making a life decision here. He can't waffle a little bit. He can't, you know, make the decision that you don't like.
Yeah, I mean, when does it get that personal with the media?
Well, you know what? I don't know if I fully agree with that. I mean, there was a lot of pot shots taken at the Buffalo media and Mike Harrington and the whole bunch on Twitter. I mean, and Twitter kind of breeds that type of stuff. But
it does?
Yeah, just a little bit.
I don't know. He called it pure scum to go to Toronto.
Yeah.
I mean, well, that one got me. Yeah, all right. So that was a tweet, right? Like, I don't know how we...
And what's wrong with a business person using leverage, any leverage they have to get the best deal they can? I would do it. You guys would do it.
Sure. I mean, I don't think we understand exactly how it went down. And you know, Mike is, of course, saying, you know, we didn't have a deal in place. But I'm sure the Pegulas thought they had something in place, thought they were being toyed with.
Well, the Sabres should be upset. The media is the one who really shouldn't be. They're right, supposed to be objectively covering the team.
I also don't have a problem with them asking those tough questions, though, right? Like, those were questions that needed to be asked, right?
But it's how they're asked, right? It's the tone of the questions, not the questions themselves.
I don't know. I'm not offended by that.
I just think, you know, as you say, Jeff, you're not supposed to be such a blatant homer when it comes to things like this.
All right. I mean, that's just kind of a side story to the larger picture, though. Surrounding this Mike Babcock signing in Toronto. To me, one of the interesting discussions is motivations for Mike Babcock, because we mentioned money. We touched on it. It's a huge, huge sum of money. He's far and away the highest paid head coach now in the National Hockey League. It's a huge term as well, 8 years. And how much of it has to do with the Sabres or the Babcock playing the Sabres against the Maple Leafs, whatever. But that's only part of it. The other part is legacy. It's a change of scenery. It's lifestyle. John, where do those rank? I mean, what's number one without getting inside Mike Babcock's head, but trying to figure out how he came to this decision?
I think we can get into his head a little bit. You know, Brett Popwell wrote a great profile of Babcock earlier this season for Sportsnet magazine. And, you know, he quoted Babcock, who made no bones about it. He wants to be known as the best coach of his era, and he wants to challenge himself in every way possible. And, you know, there's no bigger challenge than resurrecting this franchise. And maybe he just got a bit bored in Detroit. You can only stay in one place so long. Sometimes you just got to get moving. And you're right, 50 million reasons to move, but also a chance to do something he's never done before, which is build something from the ground up. He hasn't had to do that in any of his stops.
So, I mean, if that is the number one goal, then why wasn't it the Maple Leafs from the get-go, right? Like, why was it so murky, and why did it seem like we were so very close to seeing Mike Babcock next head coach of the Buffalo Sabres?
I think it has to do with ego. And a lot of these big-time coaches, they have this ego. Like, they think they can do almost anything. And that's not a shot against them. That's just how the profession works.
Sure.
And he said he grew up in Saskatoon, and he called Toronto Canada's team.
Yeah. I think that's part of placating,
though,
right?
I'm not saying...
Like, what else are
you
going to say?
I'm not saying I agree with him. I'm not saying he wasn't selling.
I agree with him, but, I mean, what else are you going to say?
But that, I think just that...
Sorry, people at Calgary.
That's all part of it. I think the idea of building Canada's team, he's big in Hockey Canada and building that team into what he believes can be a championship team down the road. I think that's a much more impressive challenge to him than building the Buffalo Sabres, who may have a better prospect pool, who's getting Jack Eichel and might have a better team right now. But I don't know if there's going to be a statue of him built outside Buffalo. And if you can turn Toronto into a real team after what happened the last couple of years, it's a hard thing not to pass up.
I think Buffalo is a wicked hockey market. I think if you turn that team around, you're never paying for a chicken wing again, right? Like,
or a steak, and they have better steaks there, too.
He's in pretty good shape, though. I don't know.
And you're right, though, Jeff. I mean, that's a better team to go to in terms of talent already on the books. And with Jack Eichel coming, you know, you're loaded for bear kind of thing. And let's not forget Evander Kane's there. He's going to be playing with Jack Eichel. He might have 40 goals next year.
Yeah.
But coming here is the ultimate in challenges. And, you know, Babcock, that's what he thrives on. That's obvious.
You know, there was somebody else, and speaking of the fine folks at Calgary, somebody else that, I mean, some of this rhetoric sounds familiar, right? Like, a lot of this is the Brian Burke entrance from a couple of years ago. He talked about, you know, winning a Stanley Cup here is everybody's dream. I mean, every hockey person wants to be in Toronto, wants to be the guy to turn this franchise around, to turn them into a winner. He also preached patience, sort of, kind of.
And then for a week.
That fell apart. And a big reason why his legacy here is rancid. Horrible, horrible legacy he left his franchise with. But it's one thing, I mean, saying stuff and that's all well and good. I think it'll be a different scenario living it day to day in this hockey market. Now, you touched on it as well, John. It's something he's never done before. Mike Babcock has never been in this situation with a team that's not just, you know, going to lose, expected to lose. It's almost a failure if they win a couple extra games next year, because they're still in the process of building draft picks. But I don't know, why should we automatically expect that Mike Babcock is the greatest at turning young players into great NHLers? He's never done this before.
I think he's put the young players in Detroit into positions to grow. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, you know, they're not 19, 20-year-old guys. They've been maturing in the system, and they're more like 23, 24, but they're still young in terms of NHL players. And you look at the Gustav Nyquist, the Tomas Tatars, the Thomas Jurkos, the Danny DeKeysers, Brendan Smith. Like, those are guys playing major roles for a very important team and a very good team. And, you know, when the older guys, Zetterberg and Pavel Datsyuk, go down, those young guys are stepping into big roles and performing. And that's what this Toronto Maple Leafs team needs, is somebody who can help mold the guys who are already on the team and are young and are still learning, help mold them into top-notch NHLers.
And you mentioned Brian Burke and the patience. He didn't have Brendan Shanahan here.
Yeah.
And he seems incredibly patient. And if you look at what Brendan Shanahan's trying to do, a lot of it comes back to his time in the Detroit organization. And if you look at who he's targeted, it was Todd McClellan last year. It was Blashill, who was another guy on his list. And it was Babcock, all guys from Detroit. And that's the kind of organization he wants to build. And he wants, as John just alluded to, the patience with the young players, the development. And that's not, Toronto, the players have been rushed. And you look at how Kadri's been handled and how Gardner's been handled.
Right.
That's why Babcock was their number one target. Not only his past experience, he likes that he came from Detroit. And that's the kind of organization he wants to build. And hopefully those aren't just words. And they want to actually show patience and actually develop an organization from the development level.
And I don't think that they are just words. Yeah. I think that right now is the window of a 2 to 3 years where this regime has the currency with both the fans and the media to actually try and build something from the ground up. You know, after that, you're going to get impatience again. If you're not making the right draft choices, if you're making poor decisions on the free agent market and bad trades, then you're in trouble. But this is a time where you can legitimately strip it down and start anew, and nobody's going to be overly upset about it.
I would agree with you, but I mean, we've been here before, right? And we were here. They had the currency to do it when Brian Burke showed up.
But he blew all that currency because he traded for Phil Kessel and signed some veterans right off the bat.
Right.
And showed to the fans that no matter what he was saying, he was just paying lip service to a rebuild. He was trying to jumpstart it and, you know, jumpstart his legacy here in this city.
And he misevaluated the situation. He thought the team was a couple players away. He signed Mike Komisarek. He signed Boschman. He thought, and he claimed Gerber off waivers. Another thing that,
don't
get me started on that. But I think Brendan Shanahan sitting here and seeing the disaster that was last year, that was the worst, most unwatchable Leaf team I've seen in almost 20 years. I think after that, you kind of, you change your, I don't think they're going to misread the situation after maybe one good year if the team overproduces next year.
I love old man Simmons talking about the 20 years.
What is his number one job in Toronto, Mike Babcock? Is it developing the young players? Is it changing the culture? Of course, we don't know the entire makeup of this team to start next season, whether Phil Kessel, Dion Phaneuf are going to be on it. I think I'd be surprised if both are on it. But what's, Jeff, in your opinion, when talking about Mike Babcock and the checklist of things that are most important for him to accomplish this coming season and over his tenure? Over the next 8 years with the Toronto Maple Leafs, what are they?
In terms of Kessel and Phaneuf?
Well, in terms of what his priorities are, like what is the most important thing that Mike Babcock is going to bring to this franchise?
You have to start developing a core of players with the right attitude and the work ethic, and because they haven't had that.
So it's like the culture thing. Then.
The culture thing is real, because look what happened last year. They brought in a new coach, they treated him like a substitute teacher, and they just complete tanked. And the guys who they're trying to build this team around, the Kessel, the Phaneuf.
I generally agree with you, but like, there's something weird happened when Peter Horacek took over, because the style of play did change, like, significantly, like, immediately.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I get it. Yeah, okay, eventually it was a joke, right? But off the hop, they were playing differently. The wins weren't coming, but they weren't allowing the 50 shots a game anymore.
Well, Horacek was trying to institute a system from that the executives want.
Yeah.
And I think what we saw was the players on this team aren't capable of playing that way.
But they tried, right? Like, they did try, at least at first.
I think they tried. I think some of them tried for the next 40 games. But I think what we saw was that the guys you need to buy in the most either didn't buy in or were unable to do what was needed. You know, if they want to play an analytics hockey game and a style and a system, that team last season or this season proved that they don't have the players to do it yet.
Yeah, and they were they were unlucky a little bit too. I know people don't want to talk about it. They were unlucky quite a bit over the Peter Horacek era.
Yeah, I think
they were limiting
snowballed
shots
on them, right? Like, you know, it started off poorly and they were unlucky, and then everybody kind of slumped their shoulders, and the next thing you know, you're winning three games after January.
Yeah, and it was the core players. That was why I keep bringing them up. The first line just tanked under that new system. Mm-hmm. And those guys under Carlisle, as flawed as the system was, they produced at a high level.
Yeah.
And other teams at least had to fear that top line, as one-dimensional as they were. Now you got Babcock coming in. I assume they're going to want to play a similar possession-style game. That's what they did in Detroit, and Babcock's a believer in analytics, and so is the front office. So can you go forward with these guys? The Kessels, the Phaneufs, the Bozak.
Right. Again, we don't know who's going to be back next season. I think we'd be surprised if it was both, maybe even either.
Then that's the question, right? I mean, Ben, you asked what's Mike Babcock's number one job right now.
Yeah.
But what's Brendan Shanahan's number one job? What's the front office's number one job? Is it to move the guys out that everybody's talking about? Is it to dump contracts? Is it, what is it?
It's to acquire young assets, right? And part of that is getting your top five pick in the upcoming draft. Well, one of your priorities was getting a head coach. So you check that one off.
Yep.
Maybe a GM would be nice. I don't know.
Yeah, I think you got to find the right guy who wants to be part of a cabal, right? A regime. And
right.
Who isn't looking for all the power and is looking to work with guys who have their specialties, whether it's capologists or analytics believers or what. I mean, it all flows up to Shanahan, but there's going to be four or five guys there who are making group decisions, including Babcock.
Well, and these big decisions we're talking about, the Phil Kessel, the Dion Phaneuf, the multitude of trades that need to take place before the start of next season, are these things you can do before you hire the GM? I mean, that's...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I don't think there's a problem going to the draft without a GM because Mark Hunter's doing all that, right? Like, and we know he's a great player evaluator, but actually, like, pulling the trigger on trades, you think that it's not a problem? Like, I mean, they kept Dave Nonis around just to do that, right? Now, he's gone. Nobody, as much as we give credence to Mark Hunter's ability to evaluate players and Kyle Dubas with the analytics and Pridham with the cap and everything, like, nobody in that cabal has really interacted with other GMs as far as making trades, building those relationships, knowing what the value of players is in the NHL right now. Do you really want to be flying by the seat of your pants, making a huge deal like a trading a Phil Kessel would still be a huge deal? You're expecting a return on Phil Kessel. I don't know what you're expecting a return on Dion Phaneuf is, but Phil Kessel definitely has value around the league. Now, it might not be as high as 2 years ago, but he has value. Do you want to do that, Jeff, without a GM in place?
Well, it helps to have Mike Babcock for that situation. He's definitely got relationships with a lot of these people around the league, but I think you have to. What's the alternative? You sit on them and wait the entire season where you're cutting off half your market? It's hard to trade a guy like this with big salaries during the season. I think the draft is the key time, and if you've got a guy like Kessel, you can move him for a high return. I think you have to.
And you know what you're looking for that guy, right? I mean, it's not like you're going out and having to do like intense negotiations and everything. I mean, you're looking for an NHLer, a prospect, and a pick. Maybe two NHLers, like two roster players. I don't know. But I mean, they know what they would want. And if they put his name out there and those offers are coming in, you don't need a GM to make that move. They've got enough guys in that front office to do it, I believe.
I keep dancing around the issue. I mean, do those guys need to be gone? Or does it now make it tenable that Mike Babcock's here? Because everybody, you know, that was a popular tweet on Mike Babcock Day. Oh, look out, Phil Kessel. Time to buy a treadmill or, you know, whatever. Because Mike Babcock's going to come in here and whip you into shape. I'm sure Phil Kessel, if he saw that, would be laughing, like chuckling. Like, you don't think he's had disciplinarians come into his life? You don't think Randy Carlisle was a disciplinarian? You don't think, I mean, Phil Kessel is going to get paid. Phil Kessel has scored the goals he's scored in the shape he's in with the work ethic he has. I mean, is there any reason to believe Mike Babcock is going to change that?
I mean, in my mind, it's been proven that this core can't win. Mm-hmm. And you got to, so if that's the case, then you got to go with a new core. And I don't think it matters that Mike Babcock's here. Everybody was talking about moving out guys like Kessel and Phaneuf and Leupel before Mike Babcock was a Toronto Maple Leaf. And I don't see why the plan changes now just because he's here. I think you look to see what you can get for those guys, and you want to get those guys off your cap, and you want some young value for them, and you make those moves.
It's I mean, I was always under the belief that Dion Phaneuf needed to go. I mean, that was an untenable situation. I wasn't so sure that the Phil Kessel situation was untenable because I still believe he does. I mean, say what you will about, you know, his overall game. We know it's one-dimensional, but he does the most difficult thing in the game, and he does it pretty well. I guess, Jeff, when you're looking at a team that's going to be 25th through 30th in the National Hockey League over the next couple of years, you would think, and anything can happen. I'm sure the fine folks of Calgary that are listening to this probably thought their team would be in that boat this year, and look how that worked out. But for a team that is rebuilding, is it not more important to at least have, you know, a couple of defensemen that can play 20 minutes as opposed to the guy who can score 30 goals a season? And in that regard, would it not make more sense to keep Dion Phaneuf and trade Phil Kessel, or both of them, do they have to go?
I think Kessel has to go automatically.
Yeah.
And I think their evaluation of him is he can be a valuable player in the right situation, but I don't think that's this. Now, you cut out the media, cut out the big city. I think he's the kind of player that needs to, you don't want him around all these young guys, and you see the work ethic. And I think in a team like Chicago, like Patrick Kane, a guy like Kessel would succeed, but I don't think you want him around. I think he's a horrible fit for a rebuilding situation. Phaneuf, I would have thought, was gone. I don't. He's proven he's not the right captain for the situation, but I think Mike Babcock might change it. I think he's the wild card that might keep him around. I think having a valuable defenseman that can eat minutes is important.
But you can get that guy maybe for Phil Kessel.
And that changes the
right
equation.
Like, what if you could get what Winnipeg got for Evander Kane? You jump at that, right?
Sure.
That's the ideal trade price. But
and then you don't need Dion Phaneuf because you've got a guy, a Tyler Myers type guy, another young guy who can play heavy minutes.
Because other than Morgan Rielly, who do they have right now? Jake Gardiner, he's a healthy scratch at the World Championships. He's a talented player, but
Stefan Robidas.
No one's saying they're deep, yeah. Jeff. No one's saying that. But I don't think that you need to be deep if you're the Toronto Maple Leafs right now. And you can go find those, you know, second, third pairing defensemen out there on the market and stuff. I mean, you can fill in holes, but if it means you get to change the culture in your dressing room, then you jump at it.
Yeah, is that an ugly scene if they go into training camp next year and William Nylander's trying to make this team and there's Phil Kessel, potato that he is, you know, and everybody's looking at him, asking him questions?
I don't know. I think you keep Phil Kessel if you get the first or second pick in the draft because you need a winger to play with those guys.
Yeah.
But I also think that Shanny and Babcock and those guys are changing the culture of this team as it happens. And if you're a young player like William Nylander or anybody else and you come in, whoever they get at the number four pick, you're not coming in and thinking Phil Kessel is the example I need to follow here. You're coming in and listening to your coach, the best coach in the world, the most touted UFA on the market this year. And you're probably looking at Phil Kessel and thinking, well, that's exactly what I don't want to be, other than the fact that he's got sick hands and a good shot.
So why keep him?
Well, I don't think you do now.
Yeah.
I think you held on to him hoping against hope that you were going to get one of those top two picks. But now, move him. Go get it. Go get an NHLer and a couple of young guys and a pick for him and say goodbye. Because you want to be as bad as possible while also instilling the right values and systems into your team, right?
I get it. Yeah. I know Phil Kessel, if he is here, and I expect him to be gone as well, will not be, you know, put on a pedestal as a bastion of what to be if you want to be the next level of Toronto Maple Leaf. But I don't know, as a young player, it might also be tantalizing to look at, you know, his pay stub, which says $10 million a year and the number of goals he scored, and say, well, maybe that's a way about going about it. But I think the Phil Kessels are few and far between able to do what he does the way he does it. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Ennis alongside John Grigg and Jeff Simmons. The media, we talk about the media. We're part of the media. You're listening to us through a medium. There have been guys that have claimed the ability to deal with it and underrated it. And then upon departing, I've had some words about how crazy the hockey media is in this city. I mean, Brian Burke, Ron Wilson, the list goes on, right? Now, Mike Babcock's been in some pretty high-pressured situations. Olympics, I mean, on home ice and cups and all that. Again, he's never been in this type of situation. Accumulating,
I wouldn't say that, though. I mean,
L over L.
He's been
in the biggest hockey market in the world.
Where nobody expects him to win right away.
Right. And you know what? Next year, probably fine. 2 years, 3 years?
I think you've got two seasons of horrendousness, if that's a word.
Horrendosity.
Yeah. I think you've got 2 years of currency here before everybody starts getting impatient. If they don't see guys like Nylander and whoever they get in the draft this year improving and becoming, and guys like Riley becoming potential stars, then there's going to be some ants in the pants. But otherwise, I know, I'm so old. But otherwise, you're not expected to win. And this is a guy who's been the head coach of two Canadian men's Olympic hockey teams. He knows what it's like to have media in his face, and he knows what it's like to have to answer questions and face scrutiny.
I don't know, but even those Olympic games, don't you feel like that's a different media thing that goes on every day? I mean, those Olympic tournaments are 2 weeks. This is every day of your life.
I think it's a total cop-out. No one talked about the media pressure when Pat Quinn was here and they were winning every year.
Right. Well, winning takes care of everything, well, but they're not going to be winning the next 3 years, I think, is the key.
Yeah, but everyone likes to make this like a huge mountain because there's this tough media to answer with.
Oh, I'm with you.
The Yankees have the media.
Oh, I'm with you, man. The Yankees win again, generally.
I don't know. I think John nailed it. I think maybe in 5 years, if the team still stinks, and I know it's bad radio to keep agreeing with John.
Go ahead. I disagree.
It's bad in a lot of things.
I think maybe in 5 years, if the team still stinks, and maybe then we can talk about the media, but I think they've earned enough that right now they're almost expected to be, they're expected to lose. So what kind of tough questions are they really going to be
getting? Losing is even the thing that people want to see. They want to see the best chance at Austin Matthews coming to this team in a couple years, right? I mean, nobody wants the Leafs to win right now.
I feel like I'm talking to two people that have not spent the last 30, 40 years in this city. You're not anticipating the unforeseen. I mean, there's going to be some disastrous, moronic something.
Look what happened this year when they were bottoming out. This entire city was cheering for them to keep losing.
Right, right? They could have easily gone off into the sunset, not put forth a half-ass effort, and everyone would have been super pleased with that. What do they do? Salute gate.
Oh, I don't want to talk about that anymore. That was so long.
I'm just saying it's exhibit, you know, A, B, C of what goes on in this city. There's stupid things every year, and maybe it's a small thing that turns into a big thing because of the media crush. But I it's not just the losses. There will be challenges for Mike Babcock that we can't foresee right now, and it will be interesting to see how he deals with them. I mean, it's not just the losses. I'm with you. Everybody wants to see the losses. They won't be a problem. I'm sure they'll weigh on him. I mean, again, he's never suffered a huge losing season like we all expect him to do next year, and probably for the next couple of years. There's going to be something. There's going to be some, whether it's, maybe it's even off the ice, you know, there's going to be something that he's going to say, oh, yeah, I never really anticipated that. And boy, this is like kind of crushing every day, you know, and the day after something like that happens where the scrum doubles down at MasterCard Center. I'm just saying, and I'm not saying that it's a cop out and that it is the most difficult place in the world as far as media, because I'm with you, Jeff. Yeah. I mean, the Yankees. They got it tough, right? Tougher than the Blue Jays. And they do play every day. I'm just saying there are challenges that arise that I'm kind of surprised you guys are glossing over.
Oh, I'm not saying that there aren't going to be challenges. I'm just saying I think that they've got, you know, they've got time on their side right now. And they'll be given a hall pass, if not a free pass.
5 years go like that, man.
Well, if we're sitting here in 5 years having this same discussion, then, you know, we'll be talking about a whole different group of people.
Talking about Mike Babcock with still another 3 years left. You think
he'll last the whole 8 years?
Yeah, well, I mean, what's your over-under? Maybe that's a good way to end the segment.
Well,
what are the odds? I'm not even going to give you odds that they're in a cup final or making a deep playoff run over the next 8 years, but what are the odds that Mike Babcock survives or wants to survive or is here for the full 8 years of his term?
I'd make it better than 50-50. I mean, he just spent 10 years in Detroit. Why couldn't he spend 8 years in Toronto?
Jeff, what do you think?
The odds say no, just based on the history of the franchise. But, yeah, I think Babcock, he's going to be here the whole time. I think it's going to be a long rebuild, and they're going to let him see it through. For the point of it to be that big of a failure for him to get fired, It's hard to imagine them.
Oh,
it's,
man. Again, I feel like you guys haven't been here for the last 40 years.
I'm buying on the hope.
It's 5 years plus. I'm not saying it's eight, but he's here for the long haul for a while.
Unless he goes full Burke.
He's not. And they tell you never go full Burke. I don't know. I've just spent enough time in this city, only my entire life, and seen so many promising situations blow up so spectacularly.
You're just beaten down, eh, man?
I absolutely am.
You're just a Toronto sports fan.
Yeah, right. And you guys have been here too, and I'm so surprised you're as confident as you are. But yeah, I give him less than 50-50 to make it through the full 8 years. When we come back, Stanley Cup playoffs, the Rangers evening that series had twos. I thought playoffs were supposed to be low scoring, every game 2-1. Apparently not. Rangers win 5-1 after the Lightning score 13 goals over their previous two games and got a series in the East. Out West, same deal. We'll talk about it coming up next. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jeff Simmons and John Gregg. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Fans know that Sportsnet.ca has them covered with news, analysis, highlights, and storytelling. But the lineup also includes podcasts. Here's a taste of At the Letters, our Blue Jays podcast, from two guys who would happily wear Gustavo Chacin's cologne. I don't know. It's At the Letters, Sportsnet's Blue Jays podcast, with Arden Zwelling and Ben Nicholson-Smith.
They don't necessarily have to realize their potential this year, and I don't think anyone expects them to realize their potential in 2015, but they have to be closer to realizing that potential than they have been so far.
It's At the Letters.
Like, I don't know why anyone would ever want to fire John Gibbons. He's not the problem. He can't make Aaron Sanchez throw strikes. He can't make Daniel Norris find his stuff. Like, that's not... So he can't do that.
It's At the Letters.
It was a different experience, and all the players were saying that it was playing a lot more slowly than what they're used to.
Absolutely. I mean, you talk to guys, and they were immediately like, oh, yeah, it's... I mean, you really got to barrel a ground ball to get out of the infield now, whereas in years past, you know, we've been around the team for a few years, you talk to pitchers, and they're like, man, like, I'm getting killed on these ground balls to get through on this turf.
It's At the Letters, Sportsnet's Blue Jays podcast, with Arden Zwelling and Ben Nicholson-Smith. Go to sportsnet.ca and click on the Podcast Central logo for the scoop on At the Letters and all our shows, as well as links to listen and subscribe.
Great play by Boyle at the line to hold the line. Here comes Brassard. Cross-ice pass. What's on the score? Marty Saint-Louis. Alive too. Martin Saint-Louis' first goal of the Stanley Cup playoffs, and the Rangers have a 4-1 lead.
Hey, welcome to the playoffs, Marty Saint-Louis. He scores his first postseason in the Rangers 5-1 win in Tampa last night on CBC, tying the series up at two games apiece. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. Ben Ennis, John Grigg, Jeff Simmons with you. Welcome, Calgary. First time we've had you along for the ride. We'll get to that series in just a second, but I want to start with your impressions of who the favorite is. I mean, we're down to the final four. Who's impressed you the most, or maybe surprised you the most, John?
For me, the Ducks have surprised me the most. I mean, I honestly believe that Winnipeg had a good shot of knocking them off in the first round, and I've been saying that, I didn't believe in Frederik Andersen, and I didn't believe in what I perceived to be a thin blue line. I've been proven wrong. Andersen has been...
First for everything.
Well, yeah. Andersen has been excellent. The blue line has held up. The Ducks' depth is shining through. Guys like Matt Bolesky and Andrew Cogliano are showing themselves to be great B-level players in this league, and then... You know, Ryan Getzlaff has, if he hasn't already, he is right now proving himself to be one of the most dominant players in the league. You know, he's on like 109-point regular season pace right now, and that's in the playoffs. And he's showing leadership that's second to none. So for me, that the Ducks have, and the way that they have dispatched of teams has been the most surprising thing for me.
Yeah, for Getzlaff, it must be easy when you're so aerodynamic because you have no hair. It's a real bonus for him. But you mentioned the goaltending and Frederik Andersen. I think you were not alone in questioning whether they would have enough in net to go as deep as they've gone and look as good as they've looked. But it is also interesting to look at the four teams left in the Stanley Cup playoffs and look at just one, just Henrik Lundqvist, really, you would say, that's an elite goaltender in the National Hockey League. That's a top five maybe a top three goalie in the league. The other three guys are, they've looked good, and clearly part of that is playing on good teams. But I don't know, what does that say overall, John, about the state of goaltending in the National Hockey League?
I think you've got, you know, as you said, there might be five guys in this league. Lundqvist, Rene, Carey Price, maybe Tuukka Rask, you know, who are the A-plus goaltenders, who are the franchise goaltenders. And then you've got, you know, 15 to 20 guys who are B-level guys and are almost interchangeable. I mean, you look at somebody like Steve Mason, what he did this year. I mean, he's a scrap heap guy. You know, I just feel like goaltenders are so much better. The systems that are being played in front of them are so much better. You give them a good coach and a decent team, and anybody can lead you to glory. I mean, Devin Dubnyk comes out of the wilderness and is a Vezina nominee. Andrew Hammond in Ottawa, look what he did, and look what the team did in front of him. I mean, there's guys like that every single year now.
And then there's the Edmonton Oilers.
Sure, but the Oilers have been a horrendous defensive unit as a team. They've been coached poorly. They've been GM'd poorly. And I think, you know, they haven't had the best goalies on that team, but they haven't had a team in front of anybody there to do anything to help those goaltenders.
So mentioned the Rangers beat the Lightning 5-1 yesterday. That series now tied up at twos. And so much of the conversation headed into the conference finals was, oh, they're not scoring enough. There's not enough goals. I need to see the red light go off to get excited about playoff hockey, which maybe is a discussion for another day. I mean, you can have a thrilling 2-1, 1-0 game even, as long as there's chances. But the Rangers did play a lot of 2-1 games this postseason. Every game was tight. And game one of this series, 2-1. And then things have gone absolutely berserk, Jeff. I mean, have the Lightning figured them out and the Rangers have to adjust? I mean, like, what's gone on with the goals here the last three games in this series?
We just talked about the volatility of goaltenders. Ben Bishop's allowed 10 goals the last two games.
Right. And Henrik Lundqvist allowed 13 over those middle two.
Yeah, and he just had, 38 saves last night?
Yeah.
So these teams are both explosive offensively. They're two of the best goal scoring teams in the regular season. And now they seem to match up well against each other because the Rangers just shut down the Penguins. They're great against Washington, who's a good goal-scoring team. And maybe it's just the matchup, and the teams are just explosive offensively.
Yeah, it's, you know, that the triplets line, and Ben, I know you hate that name.
I just don't like it.
We need to come up with a better one, I guess. But
I don't know.
What happened to names like the Legion of Doom?
Right.
You're not going to name those guys the Legion of Doom. But that line is...
The replacements are like, there needs to be something about like Tyler Johnson being undrafted. I don't know. There's something there.
Yeah.
We'll work on it in the break, maybe.
That line, though, is really doing amazing things in the playoffs. I mean, I'm not saying anything anybody doesn't know, but... You know, Tyler Johnson is on like a 60 goal pace and they're defying the numbers. They're defying the underlying numbers that everybody likes to point to now, including myself, by creating scoring chances off the rush and by moving the puck and using their speed and getting the goalie moving. They are, you know, pouncing on opportunities like no other line in the game right now. And it's really obviously, I mean, it's not like Steven Stamkos hasn't been scoring, especially of late, but it's that line that's been propelling them to the heights that they've reached.
You mentioned the analytics and maybe the unsustainability. Do you think it's sustainable what they've done?
I think Tyler Johnson had 70 some odd points this year.
Right.
You know, he might be the breakout star for people who haven't watched a lot of Tampa Bay Lightning, but I mean, he's not a flash in the pan. You know, I don't see him as a Chris Kontos to go back and look at another former Lightning player. But, you know, I would say the analytics crowd would generally point to those numbers, you know, a poor Corsi and a high PDO and say it's not sustainable. But I think there is a little bit more sustainability there just because of the way that they're doing it. They are getting a lot of, like, really good scoring opportunities in high-scoring areas that using puck movement that gets the goalie moving and he's not able to set. And that's how the pucks are going in. And I think you keep that game plan going and you can sustain these kinds of numbers especially over, you know, four series, say.
It is game four of the Western Conference Final tonight, going after 8:00, Ducks and Blackhawks from Chicago. You can watch it on CBC. When we come back, Blue Jays continuing their series with the Mariners this afternoon, 107 first pitch on Sportsnet 1 and Sportsnet 590, the Fan. This coming off that 4-3 loss to the Mariners yesterday. And the topic of conversation, at least early in the week, and probably continuing now, is the future of John Gibbons. We will discuss what's gone on with this team so far this season to get them to 19-25, and if there is the ability to change it around and get into the mix there in the American League East, which is rancid. I'm Ben Ennis, alongside John Gregg, Jeff Simmons. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
2-2 delivery. Line drive deep left field. Could be a score now. Back for it. The left field returns. There she goes. Number 11 for Encarnacion. And the Blue Jays are in flight here with the game's first hit and run, leading the Mariners 1-0.
Yes, sir. Look good at that point. Blue Jays do lose, though, despite bringing the tying run to the plate in the ninth inning. 4-3 to the Mariners yesterday. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Ben Ennis alongside John Grigg and Jeff Simmons. The Jays now back to six games under 500, 19-25. But luckily for them, they play in the worst division in baseball. The American League East is not very good. They're only 5.5 games out of first, now held down by the Tampa Bay Rays. Yankees, the Red Sox, they are struggling big time right now as well. Yankees have lost four straight, Red Sox three in a row. How about this for run? You know what? It's funny. I talked about the American League East being a wasteland and a dumpster fire. Everybody in that division has a positive run differential except for the Red Sox, who are minus 42, which is incredible. Blue Jays plus 15, which would give them the second best run differential right behind those Rays ahead of the Yankees. But I think we've seen this team play to know or to realize that that's not really surprising. They've won a whole bunch of 10-2 games and lost a whole bunch of tight games that they've blown due to the bullpen. Overall, though, gents, you look at the way things have gone for this team recently after being swept in those four games in Houston, which was ugly. Rotation's been, you know, serviceable, and you could say more than that over the last time through the rotation. They got a couple of complete games, one by Burley, one by R.A. Dickey. One by Dickey was the second win in the Angels series to split the series. Now, the lineup 1-9 is a shell of its former self right now, but Jeff, I mean, is it? I know it's tough to be optimistic when you're six games under 500 and underperform the way you have, but at least they're not, the starters aren't lasting 2 and 3 innings like they were early in the season. That's good. Yay.
Well, at least something's working out for them. At first it was the offense, and then now it's the pitching. But
right.
When you have that bullpen, it's still an issue. And even throughout this good run, they're 2-8.
Should have swept that Angels series.
Yeah, they're 2-8 in their last 10 games.
Right.
So what does that say about this? Yeah, it helps arrest the relievers and get good starts, but they're not winning games because of it. And their offense is beating up right now. They're missing a lot of key guys, and there's just not a lot to be optimistic about of this team right now outside of the terrible division.
It's a long season. Say that. I won't say it's early, even though it is early. People hate that now. You can't say it when evaluating the Blue Jays.
Cop out.
Even if it's true. After the opening day of the season, it's still not early.
Yeah, we've said the last 20 years.
Yeah, I get it. It's been
rough. Old man Simmons.
There you go. 20 years ago.
So the Blue Jays, very disappointing, naturally. And discussion has shifted to what do they do? How do they fix this? Is it a trade? Now, there was a story, John Heyman coming out saying that Cole Hamels will not waive his no trade clause. He's got 20 teams that he can say he doesn't want to go to. Blue Jays are on that list. So he's not coming here. Is it by firing the manager? Now, we've already seen a couple of firings in Major League Baseball. One of them, totally weirdo, bizarro land in Miami, putting a guy who did coach. He coached 30 years ago, high school in Missouri or whatever. And the other, the Brewers. We've seen it happen where a team will fire the manager and go on a run. Is that the right move for this team, John?
I don't know how much a manager can really affect, you know, the team as a whole, especially when you're dealing with injuries like this team is. You know, I think in the offseason, the Jays went out and tried to change the culture in the clubhouse by acquiring, you know, guys like Donaldson and Martin, who they considered to be not only elite players on the field, but leaders off the field. And now you've just run into this injury buzzsaw. You know, you got off to a crappy start in terms of your rotation, and now you're, you know, Kevin Pillar's an everyday outfielder, and Steve Tolleson's in there, and Ryan Gomes and Kawasaki is up here playing. I mean, what are you going to do? You got Josh Donaldson leading off. I mean, it's just, it's been a nightmarish start where, you know, as you said, Jeff, everything goes right one way and wrong the other, and that's been the first 45 games of the season.
And I'm not saying it makes sense that there's a thing that you can point to. And everybody, when you talk about firing the manager and John Gibbons, it's, well, what has he done wrong? You know, what has he done to deserve to be fired? Where you can look the other direction and say, what has he done to keep his job? I mean, this team is double digits below 500 over his second tenure here over the last 3 years. They've had a top 10 payroll. I think it's a cop-out to, you know, there was, John Heyman wrote a piece about the manager as well and wrote that people around baseball looked at that bench as being lifeless, which is ridiculous. Okay, you lose, you look lifeless. You win, they're full of life.
Especially when you blow so many games.
Yeah, of course they're going to look lifeless.
You're supposed to celebrate?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. But like, do sports, do we need like a sensical answer? Like, do we need to, I know, John, I'm with you with the analytics. I love them. I love evaluating sports that way. I like sense and logic. But you know what? There's this other side of sports where sometimes things don't make sense, but you can look at history and say, maybe we're going to get a return on this move. And really, how much worse can it get?
In terms of making a trade, I mean, you're looking to make a baseball trade right now, right?
No, you're talking about firing the manager.
Well, I think there have been a couple of situations this year where maybe Gibby has made a mistake and not managed things well. But
I'm not even talking about that, though. Like,
I put it more on Alex Anthopoulos, though. I mean, I've been on this show before, and railed on his seeming inability to pull the trigger during the season. He's a magician of sorts in the off season. But when the team needs him to make moves in the season, he hasn't done it. So, I mean, and you know, they had players last year calling out management because of that. So to look at Gibbons' record overall and point to that as a reason why maybe they should make a move when maybe he hasn't been given the personnel that's needed to win, I think that's a little bit unfair.
Well, of course it's unfair. Oh, absolutely. But you're not going to
fire
the GM.
So you're an unfair guy, Ben.
Yes.
You're a schoolyard bully.
Yeah, occasionally. But, I mean, I'm not looking for fair. I'm not looking for sense. First of all, you're not firing the GM in the middle of the season. That makes little to no sense. This is what you got. And I agree. Alex Anthopoulos had a huge need in the bullpen in the offseason. He did not address it.
Yep.
Now, Roberto Osuna has been great. Miguel Castro didn't work out. And maybe they found something in Liam Hendricks and Ryan Tepera. Who knows? But those are now guys that you're relying on for big outs late in games. And you know, the number of games they've blown, they could easily be first in this division if they don't blow those games. But they have. Those are gone. Here's what you got. This is where you are. You're in this position. You're with these players. You can't fire the manager. You can't fire the GM. You can't make a huge trade. What are you left with? Well, maybe you can fire the manager. Maybe you can. Maybe that does something. And again, like Jeff, like what's the worst that can happen? Well, there's 7 games under 500. I mean, really, where can you go from here? Like, aren't you looking at just a possible positive development from making a move like that?
See, a lot of the numbers guys will disagree with me, and they usually do, but
yeah, we're numbers guys though too. Like, and I know
your
you
last
like
name
the numbers.
Is Simmons,
right? Yeah, but I that's true. I'll look at these at least though. He's just an old man. For me, I'm a big believer in the manager. I saw what Buck Showalter did with Baltimore. That team just all of a sudden played great baseball. They played great defense. Not so much this year, but I see what Joe Maddon's done in Tampa, and I see what he's doing in Chicago. They have great players.
Again, yeah, it's like players. You still need the players. You can't take...
At some point, you look at John Gibbons. He's been a 500 manager right around there. I think he's 493 career, his whole career. Maybe there's something to that.
We just talked about goalies in the NHL and how there's like 4 or 5 elite goalies and everybody else, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that the same in baseball? Like, who are you going to go get to replace John Gibbons? Like, who is... Give me a name. Who's out there?
Well, I mean, Pat Hankin is somebody that people are looking at as maybe one day down the road becoming.
That's like hiring an OHL coach to coach your NHL team, isn't it?
No, it's actually kind of going in the direction that major league managers are going and getting former players. Now, of course, yeah, you're not talking about a guy who's done it in the minor leagues, but I mean, Jeff, you look at a couple of the new hires around baseball. These are former players.
Yeah, Brad Ausmus has been really good in Detroit.
But that's not a new phenomenon. I mean, Mike Socha has been in L.A. for, like, what, 20 years almost? And Joe Torre is the greatest manager ever, and he was a player. I mean, it's not a new thing to see former players being hired as managers.
Sure. We just haven't seen it in Toronto. We haven't seen, like, the great
Buck Martinez.
Sure, yeah, we saw it, and that was kind of blew up in the Blue Jays' face. Maybe that's one of the the reasons against it. But I'm just saying, and you know what? Maybe it's not Pat Hankin.
Cecil Gaston?
John Gibbons was a player in the major leagues.
John Gibbons?
Yeah. No, I think he has like 5 at-bats in the major leagues.
Career
minor
leaguer. Yeah.
Okay, and I know who you are replacing him with. Yeah, it's not an unfair question to ask because clearly, like, that's a big part of it. If you're firing the manager, who comes in here? But I'm sure you can find somebody. I don't know if it's Dusty Baker. Goodness, I hope it's not Dusty Baker. I think the game has passed Dusty Baker by. But there's somebody. And again, like, aren't you willing to try anything? Are you just adverse to this because it doesn't make sense? Like, do you want logic in everything in your life, John? I can't deliver that to you.
No.
I'm sorry.
I live my life by my passions and emotions, Ben.
Good.
But I would say that this team hasn't had an opportunity to show what it can do yet. And I think it'd be unfair to put it all on Gibbons by firing him. I think if they get healthy and continue to roll along at 500 or worse, then you're looking at the manager. The question is, how long does it take for them to get healthy and kind of get starts and get offense at the same time? That is yet to be seen, right?
It's a relatively new development that they've been as unhealthy as they have. I mean, they started the season relatively healthy. And I know Jose Reyes was banged up and Jose Bautista can't play right field.
Well, Michael Saunders has barely played, and Reyes has been banged up, and Bautista can't throw.
Right.
You know, Cabrera hasn't played much at all.
You might not be healthy all season, though. You might not.
I know.
And at what point do you wait? Where's the line you
right,
say?
Right, exactly. What is the date? Do you have a date in mind?
No. I mean, what can I tell you?
June 1st?
I can't.
Yeah.
My date is whenever they can field their A lineup for the first time. But if it keeps going on this way, then how many games under 500 or how many games do you have to have played and still be in last place of the division before you start looking at, okay, what can we move to get assets? Because our guys like Bautista and Encarnacion and Dickey and Burley, their contracts are all up after this season or next, and they might be at the top of their tradability right now.
Well, how much of this is all mitigated by the fact that they do play in the worst division in baseball? I mean, if the Rays or the Yankees or somebody was 10 games over 500 and the Blue Jays were looking at it like a 10 game hole between them and first place. I mean, Jeff, would we not be looking at at this entirely different? Now it's a dire ish scenario being 5.5 back and 6 games back again. We're not even to June yet, but I mean, 10 games that's huge at any point in the season. But the fact that this division stinks and you look at the problems that the Red Sox and the Yankees have. You want to talk about injuries. Again, like, for the Blue Jays to complain about injuries, Yankees have been beset by injuries. The starting staff, I mean, Tommy Johns and Masahiro Tanaka is apparently working his way back. And the Rays, I mean, you want to talk about injuries? The Rays got an incredible number of injuries, but for whatever reason, they're able to put it together.
They got the best staff in the division, right?
Right. I don't know. I just, there's something.
The problem is that you got four teams you got to jump. At this point, there's no way you're going to claim a wild card spot, right?
Well,
I know you still have 120 games to play.
Yeah.
But, you know, unless things turn around quickly, you're putting yourself way behind the eight ball for a wild card, and you got to jump four teams in your division to make the playoffs.
I just feel like the panic, not that panicking is good, but the desperation, like, there should be a little bit more of a sense of I got to do something here if I'm Alex Anthopoulos, not just to save your job, but hey, we've tried sticking it out. Let's try something. Like, I'm willing to, and he did it a little bit bringing the 20-year-olds to Major League Camp, and then having them make the team, and then running six rookies out there on opening day, and it paid off with Osuna and Travis, and maybe not so much with Pompey and Castro. But he tried something different, at least with that. With, I guarantee you, a couple years ago, Alex Anthopoulos isn't doing that. He felt the pressure. He felt the need to win. So if that's where he's coming from, well, why not can the manager and see if that works? Because doing what you're doing right now is not working.
Exactly. There's roster issues here, especially when Bautista's hurt and he's stuck in the DH role. You're limited versus...
Right. Maybe Justin Smoke would be having a good season. He can't get on the field right now, though.
Exactly.
But that's got nothing to do with the manager. That's just bad luck.
Sure.
That's always bad luck.
Again, but we're talking about things that are unexplainable, right? Like bad luck, whatever. I don't know. Why does it seem like the best managers always have good luck, right? Like, I don't know.
Maybe they got the best personnel.
Maybe they're into voodoo. I don't know. Maybe you need to find a manager who's into voodoo. I don't know. Or has like some sort of magic.
Pedro Serrano.
Yeah. All I know is that what's gone on with the Blue Jays, not just over the last 3 years, really over the last 20, they've had good teams. For whatever reason, it hasn't worked out. And trying to apply logic to the situation hasn't worked so far. So why not try something illogical?
So around the table there, Jeff, fire him or keep him right now?
I would fire him.
Ben?
Yeah, I'd probably fire him.
You guys are heartless.
You want to keep him?
I'm going to keep Gibby around for a bit more, yeah.
A bit more? Well, you're ringing endorsement.
As I said, until they can field an A lineup, it's not his fault. I haven't seen him make enough mistakes.
Me neither.
I'm going to say, yeah, it's not his fault. He keeps bringing up logic. He can't get these relievers to all of a sudden pitch. I'm just going to try
something. Anything. But yeah, right now the lineup is in shambles. I mean, when you got Ezekiel Carrera leading off and Munenori Kawasaki necessary at second base, yeah, you got some issues. Jose Reyes on his way back, though. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Ben Ennis alongside Jeff Simmons and John Grigg. So overall, I mentioned that the pitching staff has been pretty good the last time through the rotation. Marco Estrada went seven strong. Yesterday, they're playing not the greatest offenses in the world, too, which helps. Let me tell you. I mean, the Angels came into that series the worst hitting team in baseball as far as scoring runs.
Which is amazing. Right?
Yeah.
That's just amazing.
Yeah.
Well, outside of Trout, their averages are terrible.
Yeah. You got Albert Pujols, though, and yeah, they can't score. They're the best pitching team in baseball, which has helped them get over 500. But the staff, the starting staff now, are we gaining confidence in them? Like, is there is a move to be made. Daniel Norris has looked good-ish at times in AAA. He's not blowing the doors off or anything. Are you comfortable with this, or at least more comfortable with this rotation as it stands right now, Jeff?
Yeah, I'm a little more comfortable. Aaron Sanchez has really started to come around, and he was walking guys like crazy.
Yeah,
it's gone a little bit better, but you've seen the kind of stuff that you've wanting to see, and Burley and Dickey, those starts this week were, especially Dickey, were very promising, and you knew they weren't going to be as bad as they were out of the gate. Same with Hutchinson.
I don't know, Dickey. I was kind of looking at the numbers and seeing that everything was the same except for strikeouts, but the strikeouts were way, way down after, you know, averaging over 7 Ks per 9 the last couple of years and had an underrated season, I feel like, last year, even by you, Jeff, that the only difference between the last 2 years and his first few starts this year was he wasn't striking anybody out, even when he was good. That 8 innings against the Yankees struck nobody out, which is, I mean, you can do that if you're a ground ball pitcher extreme, but if you've never done that in your career and now you eliminated that and you still give up a pretty high number of home runs, that's an issue. Now, he seems to have, whatever he's done, and apparently Pete Walker has helped him out a lot with the delivery, he's found the strikeout again, against the worst hitting team in all of baseball. So I don't know what to make of it. But Estrada seems to be a thing, John. Like Jeff said, Sanchez is kind of coming into his own. Mark Burley is Mark Burley. And Drew Hutchison, I think we were all expecting him to maybe take that next step. I mean, he was the opening day starter. He's turning into something. I mean, if they got this kind of starting pitching early in the season when they were hitting, I mean, we could be talking about a totally different scenario right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's fair that the last week to 10 days have looked good. I mean, for me, it's the season in terms of the starting rotation rests on what Burley and Dickey can do. if they can be 200 inning guys and 30 starts and 3.5 to 4 and just eat those innings and take the pressure off the guys like Hutchinson and Sanchez and Estrada and whoever else they decide to run out there this year, then this team has a chance to turn it around. But if one of those guys, let alone both of them, continue to roll along at 5.5 or 6 ERAs, I mean, this team is in huge trouble. Huge trouble.
We haven't touched much on the bullpen, which is, it's been bad. There's no question about it. They had 3 blown saves last week. In a week, and that's crushing. They, like I said, they should have swept that series against the Angels. They blew a couple of games. And won 2 other convincingly. You know, I think by now that Roberto Osuna is lights out whenever you call on him to come out of the bullpen. Brett Cecil is back to being Brett Cecil. Aaron Loop's kind of an interesting guy. He's kind of a polarizing guy, I find, by a lot of the fan base, because the numbers look good. When he blows up real good, and it doesn't look so great. He was kind of nickeled and dimed and bad lucked in Houston in that the one horrible outing where he gave up 4 earned runs without getting it out. What do you mean? What's your Aaron Loop take, Jeff?
Yeah, I saw Eric Smith's tweets that kind of
firestorm.
Yeah,
started by Eric Smith.
I kind of understand what he's thinking. There's something uneasy about him, but I think he's a better pitcher than he gets credit for. The ERA is not good this year. It's 5.87, but he's been a pretty reliable pitcher, especially against lefties. There's just something about him in big spots. Kind of the thing Jason Fraser used to have.
Yeah.
Every time there's a big spot, the numbers don't always say this, but he just gives you an uneasy feeling.
He's been getting worse as the season has rolled on, right? I mean, that's the problem, is he was your most reliable guy or one of the 2 most reliable guys early on, and now it's not looking good pretty much every time he comes out of the bullpen.
There's lots of things that you can blast Alex Anthopoulos on, right? Like, Some trades don't look so great. I mean, the J-Hap trade doesn't look so great right now.
You'd love to have that guy on your staff right now, right?
Yeah. I mean, there'd be days where you didn't love it, but yeah. It's certainly, he's given you more than Michael Saunders has. And I know it's a fluke injury that Michael Saunders suffered, but he's a guy with career of injuries. Maybe not of the fluke nature that this one is, but I mean, it's not surprising he's on the DL. But I think the biggest thing you can drill Anthopoulos on is this bullpen. I mean, it was one of the worst in baseball last year. They didn't do anything to it in the offseason. Wanted to rely on 20-year-olds and stuff that they're throwing at the wall. And I get it that relievers are volatile and they come out of nowhere. And maybe they have. And Liam Hendricks, who all of a sudden is throwing 97, and Ryan Tepera, who's now been much better as a reliever since going that route in the minor leagues. But they've already given up a whole bunch of games because of the bullpen. I mean, how much of this is on Alex Anthopoulos?
Oh, I think a ton of it. And you look at Houston, who spent a lot of money on relievers,
right?
Gregerson and
Neshek,
and it's really stabilized their team. And there's a couple guys. Jason Grilly was available. He got, I think, 3 years, maybe even more of what
John Axford.
John Axford. And you look at this, and it adds up. You see Alex is really good at acquiring assets, but the one thing he hasn't really shown is he can put together a winning baseball team. They haven't really won more than 83 games since, I think, 2010. And part of this is he leaves gaps in the team, and it might be a financial issue, and there's depth issues and there's gaps, and this year the bullpen. What's the bullpen if Osuna doesn't come out of nowhere?
Right.
Yeah, I have a hard time giving Anthopoulos a failing grade for the offseason, considering Russell Martin and Josh Donaldson are Blue Jays now. But I will say what he needed to do was find a 9th-inning guy. Because imagine if Osuna's your 8th-inning guy and it all the dominoes fall that way and you're not relying as much on the Loops or Delabars or whoever in high-leverage situations, right? I mean, if he had gone out and made that move and found a reliable flame-throwing closer or gone out and picked up a couple of guys to see who it could possibly be. I think we're having a different conversation right now about the bullpen, but let's not forget, you know, he brought in 2 guys who are currently like top 20 in the majors in WAR, and yep, a legitimate MVP candidate in Donaldson, and Russell Martin is an all-star right now and is killing it for the Blue Jays. Where would they be without Russell Martin? It would not be pretty.
And that's exactly what I mean. He's incredible at acquiring assets. He's made an incredible amount of trades. He's drafted really well, but that's the confusing part about Alex Anthopoulos. There keeps leaving these holes on the roster.
He does seem to put his eggs in one basket every offseason, and it's always the other basket that kills him.
Right.
Yeah, he has hugely successful moves and also hugely, like, look at the bullpen. Like, they didn't do anything.
Yeah, and look at the offense. It's been pretty good, save for recently, where they trotted out the Buffalo Bisons for the most part. When we come back, the MasterCard Memorial Cup getting underway yesterday in Quebec City at the Colisée, and it was the hometown Remparts coming away with the 4-3 win. Pressure's on them after losing in Game 7, double overtime of the Q Final, kind of in the same scenario as the Mississauga St. Michael's Majors a couple of years ago, where they were a great team and losing in a Game 7 in their league final and then hosting the Memorial Cup and having the pressure of needing to come out of that with something, to have a trophy this season. We'll talk about that. Also, the Argos moving to BMO Field, and as you heard on the update, Dan Riccio, people wearing the red, not going to be wearing the red today. They're upset wearing black because there's a football team moving to the soccer stadium. And plenty more coming up next. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside John Grigg and Jeff Simmons on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Don't sweat the technique.
Sportsnet May, Sportsnet Magazine Live. That's what it's called.
It is May.
It's May. All right? Barely. Didn't feel like May this morning. John Grigg was covering his petunias. A little frost warning.
What? I was doing what?
Yeah, that's not a euphemism, okay? Actually meant flowers. Sportsnet Magazine Live, Ben Ennis alongside John Grigg, Jeff Simmons on the Sportsnet Radio Network. The MasterCard Memorial Cup getting underway yesterday in Quebec City at the Colisée. Last big event for the Colisée, and they're hoping to go out with a bang. So far, so good. The Remparts beating the Rockets yesterday 4-3. Some names you will recognize on that Quebec team: Anthony Duclair, Zach Fucali. They're looking for something, because the way the MasterCard Memorial Cup works, obviously, is you've got the three league champions in the CHL, and then you've got the host team. And the way they usually award the Memorial Cup is to a team that they know is going to be pretty good. That they were in the final of the Q, and double overtime of a Game 7 means they were really, really good. They lost that double overtime Game 7, though. So I mentioned this early in the show. I was hosting Mississauga St. Michael's Majors Hockey on Rogers TV those years ago when they hosted the Memorial Cup, and they went to a Game 7 against Owen Sound and Andrew Shaw, and they lost that Game 7 at home in one of the loudest buildings I've ever been in. They were all Attack fans, and then they went into the Memorial Cup, made it to the final and lost. So they went through this entire season, which was incredible. They got to two finals and lost twice and had nothing to show for it. Obviously, the Remparts are hoping history does not repeat itself in that regard. But there's a lot to be excited about, John, when you're looking at this MasterCard Memorial Cup.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, first of all, it's too close to call. There's no team that stands out, to me at least, that is head and shoulders above the others.
What about the one that beat Connor McDavid? That's pretty good.
They are a good team, but they weren't the best team in you know, the country or even their own league this year. They are deep. They have good goaltending. They can beat you in a number of ways, and they play a style of game. This is the Oshawa Generals we're talking about, by the way. They play a systematic style of game where that allows them to do things like hold the greatest player not in the NHL off of the score sheet, or at least at bay, after he torches the number one team in the CHL. So I won't expect high-scoring games when you see Oshawa, but they will be a force for sure. And I think in last night's game, Kelowna looked like a team that swept the WHL final against Brandon and hadn't played in about 10 days. And Quebec looked like a team that was well-practiced and was coming off of a seven-game series, as you said, Ben, and had their legs under them. But by the halfway through the second and through the third period, Kelowna had their legs as well. And I think that kind of last 30 minutes of the game is more indicative of what we're going to see.
What is a Rempart? Do you know?
No, I don't know.
Okay. It's like part of a castle.
Yeah, so it's like a rampart.
I don't know. Right? What's a rampart?
Part of a castle.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Oh, I guess it's French for rampart.
Yeah.
Oh, it's
we should have known that.
Yeah. It's a defensive wall of a castle or walled city. having a broad top of the walkway and typically a stone parapet.
I guess that's a good hockey name.
Defensive yeah, it's not wall. Bad. Yeah, they're the
well, they're from Quebec City, wall. Which is a walled city and all that kind of good is stuff, it? Right? Okay. The old city.
All right, we like to inform on this program. Also, this week, I mean, kind of got blown up with the Mike Babcock news, but the Argos, they have a new owner, and they are moving to BMO Field, which has a lot of people upset, mostly Toronto FC supporters who are going to wear black to protest the deal. But we know, Jeff, that the Argos are, you know, I mean, an afterthought is understating what they are in the city compared to the other major sporting franchises. It wasn't always like this, really. Like, my parents, my dad grew up a huge CFL and an Argos fan, and I know they were right there with the Leafs and maybe more popular than the Leafs at times. A long time ago, though, right? Like, the culture has moved past them, but, I mean, does this do anything that they're going to play outdoor football for the first time in a long time in this city?
I don't think so. I think it's a generational thing. I think you nailed it there. I only know one person who's been on the show before, and the only one under the age of 40 who I know who likes.
Yeah,
the
you guys work with
Mike Johnson.
Mikey JMMA.
Yeah, he's the only one I know who watches Argos consistently. I talk to a lot of sports fans around my age, and I don't know if just the shift outdoors enough to make that product interesting. And the CFL it's so underwhelming in comparison to the NFL. And
I think it was awesome that Larry Tannenbaum was also talking up the chances of an NFL team coming to Toronto during like the Argos press conference, right?
I mean, if that doesn't speak to
what the Argos mean to this city, then I'm not sure what does. But I mean, let's hope for the CFL's sake that a move to an outdoor field and does create some excitement and some boom around that team, because you gotta have a franchise in the Toronto market. And I know other people outside of Toronto will say, screw it, who cares about Toronto? It's not their league, you know, but you got to have that TV market booming, and you've got to have them making money and being a strong franchise to kind of help shepherd the league through.
We won't spend too much time on this, but what is it about the CFL that doesn't work in the city? Is it the fact that it's a minor league, right? Like, and junior hockey doesn't work in the city. People want to see the best of the best, and the fact that it's you know, guys that are making less than $100,000 and that are, you know, washouts in the NFL or CIS players. Is that what it is? Is it the rules that there's a lot of kicking? I mean, there's a big part of the CFL game is kicking, which seems counterintuitive to entertainment. But what is it about the CFL that doesn't work in this city?
I think the minor league is one part of it, but I think the lack of star power, especially for the Argo. I think when they had Doug Flutie and Pinball Clemens, there was a lot bit much more support in the city. Now, who's been the Argos' best player? Ricky Ray, like, I don't know if Ricky Ray gets people in Toronto going. We're so Americanized in the city outside of our hockey interests. And
I don't want to sound like a, you know, born and raised Toronto-centric jerk or anything. But
you are.
Yeah, kind of, sometimes, I guess. But, like, this is like a cosmopolitan city, unlike many others in this country. And there are a lot of varied interests and a lot of different things to do. And, Jeff, you're right. Without the star power and without that kind of major league feel, like, you're going to see these guys, you're going to go see LeBron James at the Raptors game, you know, you're going to go see Sidney Crosby at a Leafs game, you're going to go see Mike Trout at a Jays game. Without that kind of star power, a reason to go actually watch the other team as well as your team, it's hard to draw fans, right? And I mean, if they can create an atmosphere at games that is exciting and fun and different and maybe family centric and whatnot, then maybe you do have a chance. But you know, I'm not excited to see anybody in the CFL, to tell you the truth. I can, you know, I'm not the best example, but I can't even name that many CFL players.
Well, how about this guy? Michael Sam has just signed a 2-year deal with the Montreal Alouettes. First openly gay player drafted to the NFL. It didn't work out, obviously, with the St. Louis Rams, and he was on Dallas Cowboys practice squad and now washed out of the NFL. It's not over for him. I mean, we've seen lots of players.
Yeah, washed out is a...
Well,
harsh
I mean,
term,
he has. Well, he's washed out once. Okay, he can wash up on shore and then go back for another dip in the NFL pool. We've seen this career path play out before, though. Yeah, guys come to the CFL and then end up with another kick of the can at the NFL. We've actually seen some pretty good players head to the NFL from the CFL and have very good careers. So I'm not saying it's not going to happen, but obviously it's huge news, and it's news south of the border. I'm sure he's going to have lots of extra cameras. I don't know what it says about the CFL. Now, there's some parallels people are trying to draw to the Warren Moon era of the CFL, where racially it was not a time for him to take his talents to the NFL, and north of the border, he was a great player, and then eventually went to the NFL. I don't know if that's, I mean, not to say that that's the reason that Michael Sam's not playing in the NFL, because there's not acceptance, but I think generally there's more acceptance in this country than south of the border of that. I mean, does that play into this, Jeff?
I think a little bit. I remember when Ricky Williams was up here, he kind of talked about how much he enjoyed Toronto and just how open the organization was and how willing. It was just such a different atmosphere for the NFL. And a city like Toronto or Montreal will be a perfect spot for Michael Sam to live in, and it's a very multicultural city. But I don't know if it's going to draw the interest. I mean, Cam Wake was in the CFL. He was
right.
Became a dynamic
NFL. One of the guys that's, yeah, unbelievable NFL career.
I don't know if like a pass rushing defensive lineman is enough to get people watching, despite how big this is, a big story, but I don't know if it's going to get people watching.
I just hope he's good.
Yeah,
I hope he can perform, because
that'd be good.
I think it's important for football. It's important for the sport to open its doors and to have role models like Michael Sam for young gay youth who are athletes and who want to aspire to professional sport. It'll just be too bad if he's not very good,
yeah.
You know, and he obviously has a better chance to thrive in the CFL than the NFL, because he's, you know, he's one of those guys labeled a tweener and whatnot. But I mean, I really do hope that he's embraced, first of all, by his teammates and by the city of Montreal. And I hope he gets out there and, you know, gets some sacks, knocks some guys on their ass and plays well and shows that he can be a successful professional football player.
Is it possible that this has like a PR move tinge to it for the Alouettes?
I really, really hope not. I would like to think not. Yeah. I mean, he's the classic example of a guy who nobody thinks is big enough to play in the NFL, and therefore he comes north. And I hope that's what it is.
The Toronto Raptors just sending out an email seconds ago that Terrence Ross just had ankle surgery to remove some bone spurs and loose bodies from his left ankle. So maybe that played into his overall disappointing season. There is some Raptor news as well. Dwayne Casey is coming back, signed the extension, 3-year extension last year, but his assistants are not. Tom Stirner, Bill Baino, gone. And TV Tom is a huge, huge loss.
Yeah, he's the best part of the Raptors, you know, halftime reports and whatnot for the past few years, yeah.
So they're both gone, so they got to find a new TV guy in game. It's, I guess, similar to the Randy Carlisle situation, John, if you want to go back to last offseason. And does that mean that Dwayne Casey is now on the clock?
I guess. I mean, wasn't he on the clock as soon as they lost in that first round?
Yeah.
Wasn't he on the clock even before then, as they stumbled towards the playoffs? I mean,
I don't know. I think people did kind of expect them to turn it on and beat a team they handily beat during the regular season, of the Washington Wizards, who were not playing well going into the playoffs either.
I think people were happy to have that matchup over the Bucks, but, you know, the way they played in the final 30 games or half of the year or whatever, I'm not sure that everybody was saying it was going to be a walkover or anything like that.
What do you think, Jeff? You got two new assistants. I mean, how does Dwayne Casey feel about that? Like, do you feel kind of undermined when you got this going on? Like, not unlike, well, Randy Carlisle and Dave Nonis, same thing. I mean, he had, you know, Kyle Dubas, a couple of assistant GMs thrown in right next to him. He was the GM in name, and, you know, he was making some moves, but clearly the tide was turning.
Yeah, you got to feel like you're losing control, and you're almost a lame duck coach at this point. And you lose a key part of your staff. I'm not a big fan of these kind of moves. I think it's almost taking half measures. Either fire the guy,
right,
or let him keep his staff together, because your staff is so important to what you do. And I'm not sure how big of a role assistant coach has in basketball. It's not like firing a defensive coordinator where, like, a new scheme. And Dwayne Casey's defensive schemes were issues related to the players. The players could not play defense. And his system, by bringing new assistants, I don't know how much that's going to fix that problem.
Yeah, it's interesting, especially if he does get axed at the end of the season or mid-season. Yeah, maybe Masai Ujiri is looking forward to a candidate and has his mind on somebody. I mean, Jeff Van Gundy would have been a nice guy, but it looks like if he's going to go somewhere, he's going to go work with a generational big man.
Every time I think of Jeff Van Gundy, all I can think of is him holding on to Patrick Ewing's leg.
All-time best.
Like, that is one of the awesomest.
And he will be missed on the TV side of things if he leaves.
Sure.
He is one of the best on TV. These two are some of the best on radio. It's John Gray, Jeff Simmons. This has been another edition of Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'll have Mike Wilner as we get you ready for the Blue Jays and Mariners coming up next. This has been Sportsnet Magazine Live. Hope you enjoyed Calgary on the Sportsnet Radio Network.